We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
You're listening to Focus, our morning talk program. I'm Jeff Bostard, in for David Inge. Kyle Mabry is at the controls. The producer of the program is Harriet Williamson. Included a little Simple Minds to open the show there to take us back just a few years. If you grew up in the 80s like me and went to the movies at all, you know the period was dominated by names like Molly Ringwald, Anthony Michael Hall, Judd Nelson, Andrew McCarthy, Ally Sheedy, and John Hughes. The filmmaker burst onto the scene in 1984 with 16 Candles, and through this and a few other movies really changed the way that we look at teams in film, showing what went on through their perspectives in movies like 16 Candles, as well as The Breakfast Club, and Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and Pretty in Pink. Today's guest is film journalist Susanna Gora. She's written for numerous publications, including Variety, Women's Day, and Huffington Post, just to name a few, and has appeared on TV and radio network broadcasts, including CBS, CNN, MTV, Bravo, and NPR. She's been an associate editor of Premier Magazine, where she wrote and oversaw a monthly preview section of Movies That Matter. Gora also formerly hosted a segment on the Associated Press National All News Radio Network. She's a graduate of Duke University, resides in Manhattan. Today, we're discussing her book that profiles the making of these seminal 1980s films. It's entitled You Couldn't Ignore Me If You Tried, The Brat Pack, John Hughes, and Their Impact on a Generation. Welcome, Susanna Gora.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for writing this book. I'm the age where I saw most of these movies around the time they came out or on video a couple of years later. I wonder if you could explain the people that maybe didn't see these movies at the time when they were a teen, why it was so important to fill a void and write this book and how you went about doing it.
Sure. Well, I think the reason that these movies were so important then in the 80s and the reason that they are still so beloved today is because they really captured the true essence of the adolescent experience in a way that no movies before or since have done. You got to keep in mind that before these great 80s teen movies, for the most part, films about teenagers were kind of silly and fluffy and light. There were a few exceptions over the years, of course, you know, something like Rebel Without a Cause. But for the most part, movies about teenagers made it all seem about making out and going to parties and sneaking beers. And, of course, those can be fun and important parts of the teenage experience, but what John Hughes was so smart to remember was that really important to the adolescent experience are things like wondering, where do I belong in the world? Who am I? More kind of dramatic elements of the teen experience, if you will. And these 80s films were the first to really explore those questions and to really take teens and their problems seriously. And as John Hughes once famously said to a reporter, sometimes at that age, it can feel just as good to feel bad as it does to feel good. So he remembered the kind of drama inherent to being a teenager. And so as a result, these films seared into the hearts of a generation in a way that no youth movies had done ever before.
Welcome your calls or questions for Susanna Gora, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. So you were a student at Duke, and was there one moment watching a Hughes film where a light bulb went off over your head, I've got to do this book? Or?
Yes, that's actually pretty close to how it happened. I mean, I grew up, I was a child of the 80s. I'm a little too young to have seen most of these when they were actually in theaters. So I first saw Breakfast Club, for example, when I was in eighth grade. I saw it on VCR, and it just kind of changed my life. I mean, I even at that age, I couldn't believe that someone had taken the time to make a film like this that so powerfully explored what it feels like to be a teenager. And once I fell in love with that film, I was hooked, and I discovered the other great 80s teen movies. And as I got older, I grew up, I went to college, I went to Duke, like you mentioned, and I met kids from all over the country and really all over the world who love these 80s teen films the way I did. But more importantly, I realized it's not just that we loved the movies. We were using them as sort of a prism through which to discuss and think about the important issues in our lives. And I realized that the movies had taught so many of us really how we look at the world, how we look at everything from love and friendship to sex and class distinction, money, politics, fashion, you name it. I mean, these movies impacted our worldview. And so, yeah, there was a night in college when I was sitting around with a bunch of my friends watching lots of these 80s teen movies back-to-back, as we love to do, and I just sort of had this incredible realization that one day I wanted to try to grow up to be a film journalist so that I could write a book all about the history of these great movies and the impact they had had on our culture. And you know, it was a driving force in my life. It was really the reason I became a film journalist. Every so often I would nervously check to see if someone had written this book, and I would always be so excited to see that no one had yet done it. And finally, I got to the point in my career and in my life when I felt like it was just time to do it. And I was so excited. I signed a book contract with a division of Random House in 2007, and ever since then I've just been on this amazing journey of getting to interview so many of my childhood heroes, people like Molly Ringwald and Judd Nelson and Ali Sheedy, Matthew Broderick, I mean, the list goes on, Andrew McCarthy, Anthony Michael Hall, and hearing their incredible stories about making these films that change a generation.
Now, a lot of people know the name John Hughes attached to these films, but and know that he tragically passed away a couple of years ago. But can we talk a bit about his origins and how he incorporated so much of his life growing up in the Chicago area, in Northbrook, and how he applied that in so many things about his parents, his friends in school, and what life was like in school for him into his movies?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think always the best art comes from a place of truth, you know, from things that actually happened to the artist. And that is certainly the case with John Hughes. I mean, he wove so many elements from his own personal childhood and teenhood and young adulthood into these wonderful movies. He did indeed grow up in Northbrook, Illinois, and he absolutely loved Chicago and the Chicago suburbs, and he felt this incredible kind of spiritual connection with that part of America. We see in particular a movie like Ferris Bueller's Day Off is really kind of John Hughes' love letter to Chicago. And you see, you know, how sumptuous the city looks in those shots. I mean, it looks just as beautiful and gorgeous as New York looks in the movies or London looks in the movies. You know, Chicago doesn't always get that great glamorous movie treatment as often as it deserves to. And we see in a movie like Ferris Bueller just how much John Hughes loved that city. But we also see, you know, these adventures of these teenagers going out on the town and doing these fun things. And many of those things, you know, I think were inspired by some of the adventures John Hughes had himself as a young man, as a teenager growing up in the suburbs of Chicago. But for example, you know, he was very aware of kind of the importance of class distinction in teendom, and I think he felt that he kind of grew up on the lower end of a well-off community, and he was very aware of that. So much so that he actually came up for the idea of Pretty in Pink, in which a rich boy and a poor girl fall in love, when he himself was still in high school. So we just see so many examples of ways in which his adolescent experiences are sprinkled throughout all of his great films.
Where do you think he found his sense of humor? I mean, he went from art school dropout to an ad exec and to editor at the Lampoon, the National Lampoon, in almost no time. And this was not something that we can trace directly to somebody else in his family.
That's a really good point. You know, that's interesting. I'm trying to think, where did he get his sense of humor? I mean, I know he always loved kind of classic, you know, old, more old-fashioned, what we think of as old-fashioned comedians now. You know, he loved, like, you know, watching people like Rodney Dangerfield and things like that when he was little. And when he was a teenager, he would actually write jokes and send them to famous comedians in the hopes that they would use them on their show, you know. And I think, you know, sometimes artists do just kind of appear organically without necessarily being influenced by their parents or friends or anything like that. But I do know that he always had that sense of humor. I mean, that was just an inherent part of who he was, even when he was a young kid. I mean, he had this incredible, sharp sense of humor. He loved humor and comedy, and that's why he was so well-loved at the National Lampoon, because, you know, it was exactly a perfect fit for his kind of satirical, smart-alecky take on the world. And, you know, what's so great about John Hughes with his comedy is, because he was this brilliant comic writer and director, he's been able to win over audiences who love comedies. And also because he's an incredible director of poignant, more emotional themes, he has some of the most sweeping romances ever seen in any teen movies as well. So he was really able to straddle both of those worlds.
Yeah, he was a guy who, he was not a complete nerd, but he wasn't in the coolest in crowd as well. He seemed to adapt his own style through high school.
Yeah, true. I mean, I think a lot of times the stereotype about him, people assume that he was a nerd in high school, that you know, maybe he had been a geek in high school, like some of his geeky characters, you know, like Anthony Michael Hall in The Breakfast Club, for example. But in fact, that's not really true. What I think he really was he was, he marched to the beat of his own drum, but in a kind of cool way. You know, I mean, he was really into anything British. He loved the Beatles. He had a sort of British sensibility in terms of fashion, which was unique in his high school. I think most of the kids were still dressing kind of like preppy outfits at the time. He graduated in 1968 from Glenbrook, and he was different, but I think people admired the fact that he was different and looked at it as kind of a cool thing. And another thing that's interesting is girls liked him. I mean, girls thought he was cute and handsome and funny, and girls enjoyed being with him. And interestingly enough, he actually met and married Nancy, the woman who was his high school sweetheart. So I think his high school years were probably a lot more fun and cool than people realize.
While we're still in the high school years, I have a little bit, a clip of dialogue here I wanted to play from Breakfast Club. We're talking about, there's a clip here talking with Judd Nelson, Anthony Michael Hall, and Molly Ringwald. The scene started, cut a little bit for time and language use, but we talked a bit about sports and clubs and Emilio Estevez saying, you know, I don't want to blow my wrestling meet coming up here. I'm, you know, you guys are not going to mess it up while we're sitting here in Saturday detention. I'm not going to get in any more trouble. And the nerd, Anthony Michael Hall, kind of weighs in. Hey, I'm in the math club. I'm in this group. And here's a little clip that ensues after that.
What are you babbling about?
Well, what I had said was I'm in the math club, the Latin club, and the physics club.
Hey, Jerry. Do you belong to the physics club?
That's an academic club.
So?
So academic clubs aren't the same as other kinds of clubs.
Ah, but to dorks like him, they are. What do you guys do in your club?
In physics, well, we talk about physics, properties of physics.
So it's sort of social. Demented and sad, but social.
That's a classic line. He's had such a good understanding, I felt, of teen life, and he identified the most with his actors when he was shooting the films. He seemed to bond closer to his cast than he did his crew.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he had this sort of Peter Pan-esque quality. If you think about it, he was in his, I guess, early or mid-30s when he was making Breakfast Club, and there were a lot of executives his age, or, you know, other people around on the set his age or a little older who you'd think he would have related to more. But in fact, he absolutely related the most to his 16, 17, 18, 19-year-old cast members. He was just, he was truly young at heart. And, I mean, the descriptions of him that so many of the people I interviewed gave me that was that basically he was like a big kid. You know, he had spiky hair, and he loved wearing sneakers with the laces untied, and he would have, you know, loud rock music blasting in the makeup room to get everyone excited. I mean, he was really like a kid. And I think a lot of that has to do with he had a great distrust of authority, which we certainly see that as a theme in a lot of his teen movies. He always hated the kind of grown-up, businessy, schmoozing part of Hollywood. He hated the part where you have to sort of act like an adult, if you know what I mean, where you have to be tough and make deals and stuff like that. And he loved the part where you got to have fun and be creative and be an artist and let your kind of childlike creativity flow. So I think that he just never forgot what it truly feels like to be a teenager, and scenes like the one where you played remind us of the uncanny ability Hughes had to tap into teenage feelings and vocabulary. And, you know, it's one thing, a lot of the times we see directors, once they reach their 30s or something, making really poignant films about what it was like when they were a teenager 15 years earlier. And you can understand how they would get the lingo and the mannerisms of that era correct because they lived it as a teen. But it's really interesting to think that John Hughes so perfectly captured life for 80s teenagers, which he never was. He never was an 80s teenager. So I think the important thing is, in a way, he almost never stopped being a teenager, and he never stopped forgetting the universal elements of that stage of life.
Welcome your calls or questions for Susanna Gorish. She's the author of You Couldn't Ignore Me If You Tried, The Brat Pack, John Hughes and Their Impact on a Generation, talking about the films of John Hughes and a couple other movies from that period. At 217-333-9455, or you can call 800-222-9455. Also, you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's talk about the start of his filmmaking career. He'd written a couple of screenplays, right? Mr. Mom and National Lampoon's Vacation.
Right.
And then got the, through this fast-moving career, was able to make his own film. But I think with 16 Candles, starting out in 1984, he was learning about as much as about the filmmaking process as his cast, and allowed them to ad-lib quite a bit.
Right. Well, it was really important to him to try to actually direct 16 Candles. That was his directorial debut. And absolutely, a lot of the people I spoke to said that the set of 16 Candles had almost a summer camp feeling to it. It was shot in and around Chicago and the Chicago suburbs in the summer of 1984. It was, you know, swelteringly hot that summer, and everyone basically was learning together, like you said. They were all sort of kids together, including John Hughes. And he was very close. He had wonderful friendships with the two young stars of that movie, Anthony Michael Hall and Molly Ringwald. And his connection with the two of them was really powerful and really allowed him, John Hughes, to get these extraordinary performances out of these young actors. I mean, to this day, whenever I see 16 Candles, I can never resist, even I can certainly never resist watching it when it's on TV, even though I've seen it, you know, a million times. Every time I watch it, I just cannot get over how natural those performances are, and how so many of the teen films we see today, you know, have this sort of chirpy, overacting, cheesy kind of teenage acting style. And when I think about that 16 Candles was John Hughes' first film and that he was able to bring these beautifully natural performances out of these actors, that to me says a lot about the connection he had with them. He was learning a lot, and they were learning a lot, and they were all kind of growing up together.
And the funny thing is that this movie was all kind of centered around Molly Ringwald. He had this 8x10 photo of her in his office, and who's to say what may have happened with his career if he had not come across this picture and seen her performance in this movie, The Tempest.
Right. There's a great, beautiful story behind that, which is that he had gotten a headshot of this girl, Molly Ringwald, and I think someone had sent it to him for, you know, maybe for consideration for a role or something. Somehow he had a headshot of this girl he had never met. And he was so inspired by this that he actually hung it above his desk, her picture, even though he'd never met her. And he wrote the script for the film 16 Candles with Molly Ringwald's headshot above his desk, sort of with her kind of energy, if you will, inspiring the creation of this character, Samantha Baker. And so, of course, when he was allowed to direct the film, obviously he knew exactly who he wanted to be that character, you know, Molly Ringwald, the girl he had imagined in the role all along. And I think that's another reason why it's such an incredible character. If you think about it, she was really his muse for that entire story and that entire character. And that anecdote, I love it, and it's also indicative of the beautifully powerful connection that the two of them shared as friends and as coworkers and, you know, as a mentor and mentee. I mean, I really felt honored that I got to interview Molly Ringwald because she does not do a lot of interviews about this kind of stuff. And she just told me so many beautiful memories about her friendship with John Hughes, about how, you know, they would make each other mixtapes of their favorite music and how connected they were. I mean, they have the same birthday, many years apart, of course, but they have the same birthday and they just always felt really on the same wavelength. You know, they would finish each other's sentences. I mean, this was an incredible artistic and friendship connection that the two of them shared, and I really think it comes sparkling across on screen.
We got a caller on line one in Urbana. Go ahead.
Hi. I would like to ask two questions, if I could. The first question was, the author had mentioned that she got to talk with her idols in writing this book, and I wondered if they lived up to her expectations, if they were kind. And then the second thing was, I think I had read somewhere that some of the actors kind of became estranged from John Hughes later, and if she could talk a little bit about that. And I'll just hang up.
Sure. To answer your first question, honestly, I was a little nervous, you know, going into this to be able to interview so many of the people I admired so much growing up because, you know, I've been a film journalist for many, many years, and a lot of actors and celebrities are really wonderful in real life, and a lot of them are not wonderful in real life. And even though I'm a professional and I could have handled it either way, of course, the little girl in me who loved these movies so much would have been very disappointed if the actors had been unkind or just not very warm or what have you. But let me tell you, I was so incredibly happy to get to speak with them because they were all warm and wonderful and kind and interesting and, you know, better than I ever could have dreamed. I mean, for example, Judd Nelson, he's a wonderful man. I mean, he is so kind and funny and intelligent. Ally Sheedy, just an incredible human being. I mean, just a wonderful, wonderful woman. And these are just two of the dozens of people that I got to speak with. They were all just wonderful. And, you know, part of that may have been that the people that agreed to speak with me, you know, meaning like if they said yes, that probably implied that they were happy to talk about this era in their lives and everything like that. So it may have been sort of a self-selecting group that the people who said yes were going to be nice and happy to talk about all this, although almost everyone said yes, which was wonderful. But, you know, they were great, and if anything, it just added a beautiful layer to my great feelings of admiration that I already had for them. And then the second question, yes, about how a lot of the actors sort of stopped being as close with John Hughes, that's actually a big part of my book, and I get into great detail about that whole sort of sad part of the journey. There's a lot of reasons as to why that may have happened, but I think just to really sum up something that I go into great detail in the book about, it probably just has to do with, you know, the actors were getting older. Maybe they wanted to try more kind of grown-up roles. And I think that John Hughes was possibly wanting to move on as well, get out of that teen genre before he became totally pigeonholed in it. But they were so meaningful to each other that it was sad when that chapter in their lives kind of came to an end. And that's definitely something I go into in great detail in the book.
Thanks so much for the call. You were on NPR just over a year ago. You were on Weekend Edition along with Howard Deutsch and Ally Sheedy and reflected on some of this. I believe Scott Simon asked Mr. Deutsch why he stopped making movies, or at least why he stopped making movies about young people. And do you think a lot of these actors, I mean, I would assume a lot of them probably didn't get to have that final conversation or, you know, check up with him in his later years because John Hughes seems somewhat reclusive.
Yeah, I mean, that's another very interesting and important and kind of bittersweet part of this story, which I definitely explore a lot in my book, which is, you know, why did John Hughes leave Hollywood? Why did he stop making movies? And everyone has a theory about this, and unfortunately, you know, we may never really know the complete truth behind it. But I think one popular theory was that he had set out to make these great movies, and he made them. And he knew that the films were going to be, that the great teen films were going to be artistically appreciated and culturally appreciated, for as long as there are teenagers and movies. So basically his sort of artistic desires had been met and satisfied by the great teen films. And then, you know, he made an extraordinary amount of money he did very well from these teen films, but he made an extraordinary amount of money from things like Home Alone, just a fortune, and from the live-action version of 101 Dalmatians, believe it or not, with Glenn Close. So basically he had he'd achieved artistic things that mattered to him, and he'd made more money than one could ever want in a lifetime. And so I think, at a certain point you just get tired of kind of dealing with Hollywood and executives telling you how to do your movies and all those things. And I think at a certain point he just kind of had enough. And another theory has to do with, he'd been very close friends with John Candy. And so one theory is that maybe John Hughes felt that Hollywood had kind of worked John Candy too hard and had perhaps contributed to John Candy getting sick and dying by being worked so hard, and so that maybe that turned Hughes off from Hollywood. And another thing, really simple, that has to do with Chicago and Illinois, is that he just so desperately loved Chicago and Illinois and the Midwest, and he really hated the idea of his kids actually growing up in L.A. and being L.A. kids. And he wanted to just move them back to where he felt all of their spiritual roots were. So, but yeah, definitely I think that was hard for a lot of the young actors he had worked with. And because they had all meant so much to each other, it was hard when they all kind of went their separate ways.
Now I have to ask you, you worked on this for a few years. Did you try to contact John Hughes for the book?
I did, of course. And I knew I probably would not be able to speak with him just because he was so reclusive, and he basically never talked to reporters. I mean, not only did he not talk to reporters, a lot of the times he wouldn't even talk to actors and people that he had worked with in Hollywood. So, of course there was a little part of me that hoped maybe, because this is the first time there's really been a whole book devoted to the history and the cultural impact, and that maybe he would see this was different than just another article and that this would be the one, thing he would talk to. But unfortunately he didn't. And then he passed away. But I do truly believe that, his spirit shines through in the book, because I interviewed so many of the people who loved him, who knew him and worked with him, and who knew him throughout basically every stage of his life. I mean, I got people in there from his childhood, people from his, years in advertising, people from, of course, his whole trajectory in Hollywood, and, he's really there on every page. So I'm proud of the fact that I was able to get his spirit in there, even though I didn't actually get to interview him. And also I'm proud of the fact that he's really one of the very few people who wouldn't talk to me. I'm still so grateful that basically everyone else did talk to me. So, and of course that makes the book what it is,
We're talking about the films of John Hughes and other seminal teen movies of the 1980s. With film journalist Susanna Gora, welcome your questions, calls 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. We can go back and talk a bit about the making of the movies themselves. I mean, the first one he wanted to do, John Hughes wanted to make, was The Breakfast Club, and
right.
They were able to shoot it in sequence, rare. And I do theater, and it had to be so rewarding for them to actually be able to rehearse for a few weeks as if they were putting on a play.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, yeah, it's interesting about The Breakfast Club. He thought that would be the first film he would direct, and he had a really interesting reason behind it. He figured, okay, well, then if he made a film with grown-up actors, that they would see right through his inexperience. So he figured, all right, young people. And he figured if he made a film all in one room, that it would be easy to navigate and deal with. And so he figured, young people in one room, okay, detention. I mean, it's so funny when you think about how it all came to be. But he figured that he could kind of handle that. He could handle directing young people in one room. And as it turned out, 16 Candles was what he did first, because for many reasons it was a little bit of an easier sell, to the studio. It was a little bit more of a commercial idea. It was just sort of a better film to start with, I think, easier all around. So Breakfast Club was the second film he directed, and, of course, he wrote the script. And it's interesting you mentioned theater because, you know, Breakfast Club basically feels like a play. And I think that John Hughes almost treated it like it was a play in the sense that he gave his actors, I think, 3 weeks of rehearsal time, which is just, you know, unheard of and wonderful. And he let them be such an important part of the process. I mean, Judd Nelson spoke to me about how, you know, John Hughes would bring in different versions of the script and different scenes and let them all kind of read through and choose things and try things. And in fact, two of the most kind of famous and well-loved moments in that movie came about because of this. One is the kind of sexy taunt that Judd Nelson's character is saying to Molly Ringwald's character, where he's asking her if she's ever basically, you know, made out with a boy in the backseat of a car, you know, past 11 on a school night. This whole great thing, I won't get into it, but that all came about because Judd Nelson asked John Hughes if he could look through an older version of the script and found this great scene. And Emilio Estevez's character's scene towards the end, that powerful scene where he reveals why he's in detention because he taped another student's buns together, as they call it, and, you know, ripped the tape off and ended up removing some skin. It's a really powerful, haunting scene about, you know, why a kid would bully another kid. And that, apparently, John Nelson told me, was something that Emilio Estevez found reading through different versions of the script. So, I mean, the point is John Hughes gave the characters, I mean, the actors, incredible say in what their characters would be like. And, you know, you just see that film still, even real film snobs have to admit that The Breakfast Club is like a perfect youth film. I mean, it is a perfect story. All of the characters go in this incredible narrative arc, and it's always listed when magazines or film groups do sort of the greatest teen films of all time. It's almost always number one. That's how good it is.
The actors really bonded when they were making it, but Judd Nelson got a little too caught up in his character and didn't abandon Bender when they weren't rolling and nearly was fired.
Yeah, he was. He was almost fired from the movie. I think he got a little too method, you know. I mean, I think he had really kind of internalized the character Bender a little too much. And he wasn't even aware, really, that he was doing anything wrong. But I think when you think about that character, how there are a lot of... I mean, the character Bender on the outside is very kind of aggressive and swaggering and all this stuff. And underneath, of course, he's tender and has a beautiful heart. But on the outside, the character is kind of rough and intimidating. And so you can imagine, I guess, if Judd Nelson was kind of being that character all the time on set, that would cause the problems. So, luckily, his other actors, people like Molly Ringwald, really championed for him and said, you cannot lose Judd Nelson. He's such an important emotional part of this mix, and he got to stay. And, you know, that's something he and they were all very grateful for.
You mentioned a little bit about John Hughes always listening to different kinds of music and giving an idea what he might want on his soundtrack. Growing up in an MTV generation, it just seems so obvious for a music video to incorporate the scenes from the movie or slowly that. And you mentioned how, like, Flashdance in the early 80s was maybe the first example of that. But his films would often promote the music as well, particularly the Simple Minds song we heard opening the show.
Right. I mean, actually, yeah, there's a whole chapter in my book just about the music of these films. That's how important music was to these movies. It was a really great example of both commercial and artistic synergy, the relationship between these films and their soundtracks. It was the MTV era, as you mentioned, and these movies were hot right when MTV was becoming huge. And so, you know, for example, the song Don't You Forget About Me, which I think you played at the beginning here, that was actually written for The Breakfast Club. I mean, they actually came to the set of The Breakfast Club and walked around and got a sense of what the characters, what the story was like, and wrote the song. I mean, so that's how organic this all was. I mean, so many of the songs on the soundtrack for Pretty in Pink were written for the movie Pretty in Pink. And it's you know, we don't really see that anymore. Unfortunately, the great era of the soundtrack is kind of over. But it was a wonderful synergy because you'd see the song, the video on MTV that would play this great song. The video would include clips from the film, like Breakfast Club or Pretty in Pink. And then you'd hear the song on the radio, and the song would make you think of the movie. And then when you're in the movie, in the theater, listening to the song, you want to go out and buy the song because it's so great. And all of those different forms of media just help to promote each other. I mean, commercially, in terms of people buying those products, but also emotionally, in terms of when you're sitting in the car and you hear the song come on the radio, you get that little feeling in your heart like, oh, I want to go see the Breakfast Club again. So, and to this day, they play so many of these soundtracks on radio stations everywhere, and it helps people connect to their great memories about these films.
We can talk about a couple of movies that did not involve John Hughes. I mean, shortly after Breakfast Club was St. Elmo's Fire, and a lot of these same actors were involved in it, the Brat Pack. This is a film that, too, that a lot of people had some drama going on in their personal lives, particularly Demi Moore, who may have been trying to get caught up in her character and had actually had a drug habit going on when they were making the film or getting ready to shoot the film like her character.
Well, first of all, it's interesting because people always think of my book as sort of the book about John Hughes and his films, and that is largely true, but really it's a book about the Brat Pack actors and their films, too. And that's why I felt it was so important to include St. Elmo's Fire in this story, because that was the movie that sort of gave birth to the term Brat Pack. The way that all came about was it was a writer for New York Magazine, who I also got to interview, a man named David Blum, who was supposed to just do a little inside piece on Emilio Estevez, while Estevez was making St. Elmo's Fire. But so he went out to L.A. to interview him, ended up going out in the town with him and some of his friends, and sort of had this journalistic realization that it would be more fun to write an article about all this group of hot young actors hanging out together than just about Emilio Estevez. And the headline of the piece was Hollywood's Brat Pack, which was, of course, a pun on the term Rat Pack from, you know, the original Frank Sinatra, Sammy Davis Jr. gang. And so I go into great detail in the book about that article and, you know, the incredible effect it had on their personal and professional lives. And it was kind of a sad impact that it had, actually, because they had all just been great friends with each other and loved hanging out. I mean, Ali Sheedy told me this group of friends, these actors, it was kind of the first time in her life she really felt she belonged. You know, and then that article ran, and it was pretty negative. I mean, it really delved into a lot of their personal lives in a very detailed kind of negative way in an era when the world did not have the constant celebrity journalism that we have now, so people really noticed this article. And the actors, I think, didn't feel as comfortable hanging out anymore, and that's still kind of heartbreaking for a lot of them. And I think, unfortunately, had a negative effect on their careers in a lot of ways as well, because they got lumped together as part of this group, and it made them seem a little childish and bratty, obviously, the term Brat Pack. So I thought it was important to get into all that when talking about St. Elmo's Fire, since it all kind of happened around the same era.
But to an extent, their lives were becoming what Blum had written, and I think and they clearly had no idea what was going on when they were meeting with this writer. They sort of staged this whole thing when they were all hanging out at a bar together.
Well, you know, a lot of them kind of remembered that differently, how it actually went down. But, you know, and again, I really do get into great detail about it. But I they knew he was a reporter. They never, like, didn't know that he was a reporter, but they did think he was only writing a piece about Emilio Estevez. So you can argue that maybe anyone who wasn't Emilio Estevez didn't think that they would be covered in great detail in this article. And so, look, there's a lot of ways to look at the whole incident. And, in fact, David Blum is a very important journalist to this day, and he teaches at Columbia Journalism School. And I thought it was kind of bittersweet and poignant because he told me that he teaches his students now that you really want to be careful when you're writing an article before you label or brand a group of people, because it really can have a big effect. And I thought that was kind of poignant that all these years later he felt that way about it.
Welcome your calls or questions for Susanna Gorish. She's the author of You Couldn't Ignore Me If You Tried, The Brat Pack, John Hughes, and Their Impact on a Generation. 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. John Hughes went on and produced a couple of films that Howard Deutsch directed, produced and wrote in films that Howard Deutsch directed, first being Pretty in Pink, and
this was a film that you go back and watch and think fondly of, and never would have imagined that they didn't have the original the ending that we see was not the original ending.
Right. It's so interesting. So the way the film ends, I don't think this is too much of a spoiler since people probably have seen the film already, is that Molly Ringwald's character ends up with Andrew McCarthy's character, this kind of rich, popular, preppy boy named Blaine. And I got to interview him as well, Andrew McCarthy. He's wonderful. And but, see, throughout the film, she had been spending a lot of time with her best friend, this guy, this character, Ducky, who's this kind of wacky, lovable, weird guy, played by John Cryer, who I also got to interview. He's very wonderful. And so, but as it turns out, the way the film had originally been written was for Molly's character to end up with Ducky, John Cryer's character. And Molly Ringwald told me that all along she just felt this was not going to work, that, you know, she loved John Cryer and thought he was a great actor, but that the chemistry between them on screen was just not enough, and that she just knew in her heart of hearts this ending would not work. But they filmed it that way anyway, and they showed the film to a test audience of teenagers who loved, loved, loved the movie right up until the ending when Molly Ringwald ends up with John Cryer's character. And then the teenagers in the audience started booing loudly. And so, you know, the filmmakers all kind of look at each other nervously, and they realize, oh, my gosh, we have to do something. We have to change the ending. So they actually reshot the ending so that Molly Ringwald would end up with Andrew McCarthy's character. And by this point, the actors had all gone on in their lives and done other things. And, in fact, Andrew McCarthy was in a play on Broadway playing a soldier in Vietnam, and he had shaved his head. So when he came back to reshoot this scene, he had a shaved head and he had to wear this terrible wig, which is pretty obvious when you watch the scene that he's wearing this wig. It's really interesting because to this day people debate over Duckygate, as they call it. They don't like the fact that Molly Ringwald ended up with one guy versus the other. It's still a hot source of debate, and actually it does sort of get into people's feelings about class and money and romance, because the Andrew McCarthy character was very rich and the Ducky character was from a similarly kind of lower economic background like Molly Ringwald's character. So to this day, people still care a lot about Duckygate.
Well, we can go ahead and go on to Some Kind of Wonderful, because it was a very similar film in terms of plot, just, change the sex of a couple of characters and maybe the ending, but there was a whole lot of drama behind the making of this film. I mean, I'm reading the chapter that's devoted to it, and I'm like, how did they end up actually making the movie? There's a whole bunch of different people cast,
yeah.
And Howard Deutsch left the project.
Yeah.
So
yeah, it's so interesting because I mean most of the films that John Hughes was involved with, it was a relatively smooth process getting it developed and getting it made, and that really was not the case with Some Kind of Wonderful. Just briefly to your point about Howie Deutsch, who I also got to interview, he's great. Howard Deutsch, you know, what happened was John Hughes, he wrote scripts so quickly. I mean, John Hughes literally wrote Ferris Bueller's Day Off, I think, in 48 hours, which is just unheard of. And because he wrote so many incredible scripts and he wrote them so quickly, there was just sort of no way that he would have ever had the time to direct them all himself. And he kind of trusted Howie Deutsch to direct scripts that he, John Hughes, had written and that he, Hughes, would then produce. And so he still was very involved, of course, in the making of these films. But he didn't have to actually direct them all, and so he trusted Howie Deutsch to do that in the case of Pretty in Pink and Some Kind of Wonderful. And what happened with Some Kind of Wonderful was Howie Deutsch had been brought on to direct it, and you know, they were thinking about casting and all this kind of stuff. And then at some point, Howie Deutsch was having a hard time casting it, and he basically left the project. So they brought in this other woman, a director named Martha Coolidge, who had directed the film Valley Girl. And she had kind of a darker, edgier sensibility as an artist. And she brought in the wonderful actor Eric Stoltz. And he was excited because she had this great kind of edge to her. And he had done, up to then, really important work as an artist. And so you could see why someone like him would be excited to work with someone like Martha Coolidge. And then ultimately Martha Coolidge left. And Howie Deutsch came back, And I mean, how, you know, Martha Coolidge was fired. She was asked to leave, and Howie Deutsch came back. So then Eric Stoltz suddenly finds himself with this other director, Howie Deutsch. I mean, there was just a million things going on, all these changes. And, you know, cast changes. I mean, at one point, Colin McLaughlin was going to be in the film, and he was asked to leave. It was just kind of a mess. And I go into all this in the book. And, you know, I think in many ways that did sort of stay with the people as they made the film, because it has such a rocky beginning. But the great news was it ended up with a wonderful cast. Eric Stoltz is a tremendous actor. Leah Thompson is a wonderful, wonderful actress. And, of course, Mary Stuart Masterson is fabulous. And I got to speak to all of them. And it's a great story. And, you know, a lot of people who love John Hughes movies, like Breakfast Club, and don't know Some Kind of Wonderful. And I always tell people, you know, if you haven't seen Some Kind of Wonderful, you got to see it. It's just this gem. It's a wonderful film. It's dark and sort of dramatic, and it's not as fun or upbeat as some of his other films, but it's incredibly beautiful and poignant and powerful. And in fact, Leah Thompson and Howie Deutsch worked together and met on that film, and then later fell in love and got married, and they're married now, and they have a couple of teenage daughters, and they're a great Hollywood couple. So it's a wonderful movie, and people who haven't seen it should go see it.
I got a caller on line one from Champaign. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Wink, and I was wondering, John Hughes had such a great run of hit after hit, and then seemed to drop off the map. Are there any movies that he directed that people might not be aware of after that?
No, I mean, not that you'd really want to see all that much. I mean, he made, you know, some kind of family movies after these. He made something called Curly Sue, and something called Dutch. You know, these weren't particularly great. Actually, there was a sweet one called Only the Lonely that had Ali Sheedy and John Candy. But, I mean, no, for the most part, he made his incredible teen films. And then he made a bunch of comedies. Well, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles is an extraordinary movie.
Oh, yes.
And that was after this, you know, teen era of him, of his work. But, I mean, for the most part, no, there's no, like, great John Hughes gem from the 90s that people don't know about. I mean, he made his movies, and then he just kind of stopped.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Thanks for the call, Wink. And got a few minutes left. Got to mention Say Anything, because it kind of closes out the decade, and I sort of feel like Cameron Crowe ushered in an era with a risque sort of different script for Pastimes at Ridgemont High, and I believe it was 82, and then he made this film in 89 about a teen romance, but a, you know, getting out of high school teen romance, somewhat more mature romance.
Right, and I felt so lucky that I got to interview Cameron Crowe and John Cusack, the star of this film. I felt it was important to include Say Anything, even though it didn't have anything to do with John Hughes, because it was sort of the end of the era, of great, powerful, important 80s teen films. And I felt that Say Anything had much of the same kind of heart as the John Hughes films, but took it in a really interesting new direction, which I think made sense. You know, as the 80s were becoming the 90s, it was just a different tone and a different style, and it was all Cameron Crowe. I love this film. And by the way, Lloyd Dobler, the character that John Cusack plays, he really looms large in the hearts of so many women. I mean, there are so many women out there who are still looking for a guy who's like Lloyd Dobler to them. That film has made an incredible cultural impact, and it came really out of a really organic place for Cameron Crowe. It was a story that was important to him to tell, and you know, you can just see the incredible impact it's had on so many people, even today.
And this is a movie that Cusack didn't want to do because he'd already had quite a few roles and felt like he didn't want to be pigeonholed into this, you know, these teen movies.
Well, something that, you know, there's a lot of in my book is so many of these actors, when they've done a few teen films, understandably, then they feel like it's time to do more grown-up films. But luckily, in the case of John Cusack with Say Anything, he did agree to do the role. He was the actor that Cameron Crowe desperately wanted in the role. And John Cusack brought so many beautiful layers and so much interesting shadowing to this character. Really a complex character, Lloyd Dobler. And I know that was a collaboration between John Cusack and Cameron Crowe, and you know, it's when they do great roundups of sort of great moments in movie history, you know, when we talk about things like Rocky, you know, Rocky with his fists up above him, or Scarlett O'Hara, you know, shaking her fist in the sky or whatever. I mean, Lloyd Dobler's kind of a modern version of those great iconic moments. Lloyd Dobler standing with the boombox above his head, with the song In Your Eyes coming out of the boombox. There's a great story behind how Cameron Crowe was able to get that song for that film. But it has affected people very profoundly, and it's an excellent, excellent film.
Got just a couple of minutes left, and it seems like you've got everybody you wish you would have liked to have talked to, obviously, except for John Hughes. I assume you probably get asked this now and then, but is there one thing you would have liked to have asked of him, or if you had, you know, just a couple of minutes?
You know, I would have asked him, even I, after years and years of studying this, I'm not sure I know the answer, I would have asked him, what was it about the teenage heart and the teenage stage of life that so compelled you? I mean, I have some theories as to why that is, and I have, you know, lots of reasons as to think why he felt that way about that era of life, but it would have been wonderful to have heard exactly from him why he felt that way.
Do you think anything will become of these scripts? The other thing that I heard, and I encourage people to go back and listen, it was April 9th of last year when you were featured on Weekend Edition with a couple other experts in 80s films, Ali Sheedy and director Howard Deutsch. But apparently Hughes' family said there are a whole bunch of scripts just laying there, and I guess it would take the right person the right concept.
I mean, it's a real treasure trove, as you can imagine. And I think that the family will decide if and when there's a time to, you know, kind of let any of those out into the world. But the thing is, you know, I'm not so sure that they're really going to end up remaking any of these films. I mean, I think the films themselves are timeless. And today's 15-year-olds love these films. I mean, I really don't see a real reason to remake the originals because they're so beloved and so timeless. And in fact, I interviewed a teenage girl who told me that watching these movies is sort of, you're not an adolescent until you've seen these films. I mean, they've really become a rite of passage and a part of the American experience of growing up. And the impact they've had on our culture just goes on and on and on. And I don't think we need to mess with the originals too much.
Susanna Gora is the author of You Couldn't Ignore Me If You Tried, The Brat Pack, John Hughes and Their Impact on a Generation. Any final notes? Any projects we can hear from next about the world of film journalism from you?
Well, just I've been honored and thrilled to go around the country doing readings and signings of the book and meeting people for whom the film has meant so much. That's just been an incredible honor for me to experience that. And the book is available now in paperback, and people can learn all about it at bratpackbook.com.
The book is published by Three Rivers Press. Susanna Gora, thanks so much for joining. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.